Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motyka, your host for an hour of medical debate, dialogue, discussion, health in the news, and a variety of topics. And before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. This weekend, I'm attending another Institute for Functional Medicine short course entitled Understanding Biotransformation and the Recognition of Toxicity. In this class, I'll learn new methods of diagnosis and treatments for people suffering from environmental toxins. Appropriate to this, I recently read the new book by Dan Agin, More Than Genes, What Science Can Tell Us About Toxic Chemicals Development and the Risk to Our Children. So today, you'll hear an interview with this author about the challenging problem of our complex chemical environment and how it poses risks to the development of our children. Dan Agin is Emeritus Professor of Molecular Genetics and Cell Biology at the University of Chicago. He received a PhD in biological psychology from the University of Rochester and has done research in neurobiology, physiology, and biophysics at the University of Chicago. In reviewing Dan Agin's recent book, More Than Genes, the theme that came through as the best description or a synopsis of what this program is going to be about is that recent science demonstrates to us that influences of the prenatal environment can affect the individual lifelong. Dan, that's a pretty big topic. I think you do a very good job with it, but I'm going to let you start us off. What are the most fundamental issues in terms of the prenatal environment?
Let me make a few points which I think are of utmost importance. First of all, I think we have to understand that the placenta acts as a filter to keep toxic chemicals that are in the maternal blood from getting into the local environment of the embryo or fetus, but the efficiency of the placenta as a filter differs from one woman to another. And the differences are not yet understood, so that we have differences between women, variabilities that we really don't know about. And because of that, it's not possible to predict which pregnancies are more vulnerable to toxic impacts. That's a very, very important point, because one question I continue to get from people is everybody vulnerable? No, not everyone is vulnerable. Some people are and some aren't, and the differences in vulnerability are not understood and not known. Secondly, there's a question of responsibility when it comes to toxic impacts. Every pregnant woman is immediately concerned, question of how responsible she is for damage to the fetus by environmental impacts. There are several points that I want to make right up front about this. First of all, there are some potential dangers that no one can control. For example, there are toxicities we don't even know exist yet. It's estimated that about 80,000 synthetic chemicals in our environment, and only a few hundred have been investigated. So most of the synthetic chemicals that we know are present in our environment, we don't know which are toxic and which aren't toxic for the fetus or even for children and adults. Secondly, some potential dangers are dangers that individual pregnant women can't control, but most of the dangers they can't control. For example, there are dangers that can only be controlled by local, state, and federal agencies. If not complete control, then at least testing of air, water, and food, which is relatively rare and much rarer than it should be. People don't even know what's in their air, water, and food, let alone face the problem of how to control what's in their air, water, and food. And finally, there are potential dangers that can indeed be controlled by individuals. For example, tobacco and alcohol use. Alcohol use is very insidious because, as I point out in the book, a woman who expects to be pregnant is using alcohol, and then she stops using alcohol after she knows she's pregnant. There's a period of a few weeks or even more during which she has conceived, but she doesn't yet know that she's pregnant, and if she continues to use alcohol the embryo is extremely vulnerable to alcohol because alcohol is a very simple molecule which freely moves across all cell membranes, and it diffuses very rapidly throughout the entire embryo. It's very dangerous, and we know that. There's scientific evidence for that. Now, as far as other toxic chemicals are concerned, there's a whole litany of toxic chemicals that the public has been warned about, mercury in fish, PCBs, and so on. I don't want to get into details about that. I just want to make some general points. For example, there's evidence that the majority of pregnancies are not adversely affected by toxic environmental chemicals. But there's plenty of evidence that the adverse effects are significant in numbers. I would estimate that at least 1 in 100 and probably 10 times that, up to 10%. Now, that's an enormous number of newborns. We have approximately 4 million newborns each year in this country. And so we're talking of a range of 40,000 to 400,000 newborns that have been damaged in one way or another during neurodevelopment. In fact, if you go into a school setting later on when they're 5, 6, and 7 years old and you do physical and psychological tests, you find out that approximately 15 to 17% of children in American schools have physical or psychological disabilities. And we can judge that maybe half of those only are caused by chromosomal defects. And the other disabilities, the other neurodevelopmental disabilities, are most likely due to fetal impacts, most of which we're not even aware of.
Let me stop you for a moment and ask you about those disabilities, just in the sense that, well, I guess I'm wondering about case finding, whether or not we're really seeing an increase or whether we're just improving in our abilities to identify people with learning disabilities. Obviously, both elements are, well, maybe not obviously, are both elements at work? Is this all just case finding and an increased medicalization of normal human variability?
For example, with respect to autism, which everyone is now concerned with because the published statistics concerning diagnosis have alarmed people, you know, the problem in this country is that we don't have a central registry for diagnostics. That's really a severe problem in epidemiology. The latest survey that people are all excited about, which has shown such an increase in the prevalence of autism spectrum disorder, that survey involved a survey of parents, asking parents if they have a child, any child that was ever diagnosed as autistic. And that's not a good way to do epidemiology by any means. And we do need a central registry for diagnostics because otherwise we're playing a guessing game. I for one, don't believe that the relatively large increase in the prevalence of autism is due to impacts, to environmental impacts. I won't believe that until I feel secure that it's not a question of increased diagnosis, because what's happened with autism in particular is that over the past few decades, there's been a spread of the diagnostic category to include a variety of symptoms that were never originally included in the diagnosis of infantile autism when the incidence was really very low. So I don't know how much diagnosis is a problem for that. And I think your point is very well taken, and I see the only solution to that question as a central registry for diagnostics, which we don't have. And we sorely need it. We really do need it. The CDC, when the CDC wants to estimate what the prevalence of a condition is, they have to go into one city only because they don't have information from the whole country. So they do Atlanta, for example, because they're there. So we have good statistics on epidemiology in Atlanta over the years, but we have hardly anything from most other places. And that's not really a good way to do epidemiology. It's amateurish.
You quote an article, this is from the Archives of General Psychiatry, Schechter and Grether, 2008, which I found very fascinating because in California, which has at least a fairly good registry as far as what we're paying for, somehow that always seems to make its way into the books, the California's developmental services system, which provides services to disabled children, has seen gradual increases in autism every year since mercury was removed from the vaccines. And yes. I find that some fairly compelling evidence against the idea that vaccine mercury was the cause.
Well, I agree with that totally, absolutely.
Now, I wanted to quote that and give the reference because
In my area, I've seen that urban legend just is terribly persistent. And in the light of a real threat to children's lives, which is the H1N1, I've seen parents very reluctant to vaccinate their children, even older children, 8 and 10 years old, with a thimerosal-containing vaccine, choosing instead to let their child take a risk for the disease rather than take a very small mercury hit. It's very difficult once these sorts of fears get into the popular psyche to remove them. And you make several points in your book about eugenics and other popular mythologies which have gotten out of hand in cultural history.
I think that too many people dump on the media, but I do think that the media has enormous responsibility for ignorance of the public about these things. They tend to shy away from anything that's controversial. They tend to shy away from things that alarm people, and the consequence is that people are much too ignorant about some information that's vital to their daily lives. There's a tremendous amount of confusion about the mercury preservative and vaccines, and this idea that it's okay to avoid vaccination of children when we worked so hard in public health to perfect vaccines for childhood diseases, and now there are people who say that you don't have to vaccinate your children. It's totally bizarre. It's really crazy, totally crazy.
I want to come back around to one of the other themes that I felt moved through your book very smoothly, which was the idea that the prenatal environment is really the result of political and social decisions primarily made by society and not the individual, the exception being fetal alcohol syndrome and cocaine and tobacco use.
Yes,
and even those, yes. You can argue that those are, to a large extent, social decisions, that cultural influences and maternal education are really the key way to combat those.
Yes, my view about that is that, in a larger sense, we come together to live in a society in order to help each other. This idea that individualism is the end goal of a human life, to me, it doesn't make any sense at all. When the first American settlers came here, they did not disperse immediately into the wilderness to live as individuals. They stuck together in order to survive. And we still live in a society together in order to survive. And we have problems that are a consequence of tremendous industrialization that's occurred in the past 100, 150 years. And these problems, these environmental problems, can't be solved by individuals. Individualism doesn't do anything about these problems. We need society for these problems. Now, people raise the question, I get that question very often, is it really necessary to bring in government? And my answer is yes. It's often necessary because there are things that we can do as a society that we can't possibly do as individuals, and environmental pollution is one of those things. That's the reason we live in a society in the first place. So that's my counterargument to the idea that that people should act as individuals and try to protect themselves against environmental toxins. We can't do it. It's not possible to do it. We need both government regulation and government testing. For example, the average pregnant woman is not set up to test the arsenic in the tap water that she drinks in the house, or test the atrazine in the tap water. That has to be done with sophisticated equipment by people who know what they're doing, and it's not something that can be handled by individuals. We do need society for certain problems, and this is certainly one of those problems.
Now, the field of toxicology is a field that's been around for a very long time. Fetal toxicology, the toxicology of fetuses, however, really is kind of a different animal. Can you explain for us the reasons that fetal toxicology is a different field from general toxicology?
Okay, all right. Well, the basic question is vulnerability. The estimate of pediatric toxicologists is that the fetus is about 100 times more vulnerable than children or adults. And there are three good reasons for that. A description of the reasons depends on that we look more closely on what's happening during development. Development starts off with a fertilized egg cell, which is about the size of a period at the end of a sentence. It's just barely visible. And that single cell undergoes a program of changes which eventually result in, let's say, a 7-pound infant with highly organized tissues and organs. The process from that single cell to the final birth outcome consists of many thousands of what the biochemists call cascades. In biochemistry, a cascade is a sequence of events where a particular event is triggered by a preceding event, and that event in turn acts as the trigger for the next event. So you have a essentially programmed biochemical progression. And there are thousands of these going on at the same time. And the consequence is that there are many, many points where an impact, a chemical impact, can push things in a different direction or even kill the whole process. So that's one cause of vulnerability, is the fact that you have multiple points for chemical interference. Another cause of the high vulnerability during fetal development is the pace, the rapidity of replication of cell division and the formation of tissues and organs is staggering. For example, in the middle of development of the brain, the estimate is that there are 250,000 new nerve cells being produced each minute.
Let's repeat that for those who didn't hear that the first time. 250,000 new neurons a minute.
Yes. 250,000 new neurons a minute. It's a fantastic pace, because what you're doing essentially is you're taking a single fertilized egg cell and developing about 100 trillion body cells, and it takes time to do that. It takes 277 days in human gestation, but the pace has to be tremendous in order to achieve that final count and organization of cells and tissue. So things are happening extremely rapidly, not only in the brain, but in every organ in the body that's being formed during development. So that's the second point of vulnerability, is the tremendous pace. Anything, any chemical which changes a reaction rate for some biochemical process and thereby alters the kinetics of processes that depend on that particular process can have tremendous consequences. The rapidity of change is the second important thing. The third important thing is that, especially very early, we're dealing with a really small bit of tissue. The fertilized egg cell travels for about 3 days down the fallopian tubes, and on the fourth day it enters the lumen, as it's called, the open space of the uterus, and then maybe by the fifth or sixth day it's implanting in the wall of the uterus. And the size is extremely small. As a matter of fact, by the sixth week, the embryo is still only a quarter of an inch long. The consequence of this is that any toxic chemical that's in the environment freely diffuses throughout all the tissues, all the cells of the embryo. And especially if it's a chemical that freely crosses cell membranes like ethyl alcohol, every cell in the blastocyst of the embryo is exposed to this. And the same thing is true, later on in the fetus. At 10 weeks, we stop calling it an embryo and start calling it a fetus. It's just a terminological change. But at 10 weeks, the embryo fetus is, let's say, about 2 inches in length. Now, that's still very small. So just from the standpoint of physics, anything that gets into the fetal environment by simple diffusion is going to rapidly disseminate throughout all the cells, all the tissues of the embryo. That makes the system extremely vulnerable. So there are these three things that make embryos and fetuses much more vulnerable to the same concentrations of toxins that in children or adults have hardly any effect at all. A growing child, and this is particularly true of the nervous system doesn't really finish development, macroscopic development, doesn't finish macroscopic development until about early adolescence. The brain is still developing at a very rapid rate based on its input. So the childhood nervous system is also very vulnerable, but not as vulnerable as the developing fetus.
So with respect to the fetus and toxicology, it's very different from regular toxicology in that there really is no safe dose.
Yes.
Or presumably there will be some individual out there who is the canary in the coal mine with respect to a toxin at a level that most people will be able to tolerate.
You and I will agree about this, and most pediatric toxicologists will agree with us, but there are many, many people in the medical field who will disagree with us. There are many pharmacologists, for example, who still operate on the basis of dose-response relationships, and it makes no sense. A dose-response relationship makes no sense unless you know what response to look for. In the processes that we're talking about here, we don't know enough yet to know what to look for. So the dose-response relationship is not a paradigm for deciding when you have a safe concentration, and experience has shown us that. It's shown us that with lead. Every decade, we have to keep lowering the supposed threshold concentration for lead poisoning. And the reason for it is rather simple. There is no threshold concentration for lead poisoning. There really isn't. And the same thing is most likely true for every toxin. We don't know how many molecules are necessary to affect, for example, DNA replication. It doesn't take many molecules to cover up, to act as adducts in DNA and ruin the regulation or replication of some gene. It's a different ballgame, a completely different ballgame than childhood or adult toxicology. And there's a growing awareness among pediatric toxicologists. For example, I think a couple of weeks ago you were interested in BPA, and you were talking about BPA. Most of the conversation about BPA has been about the effects on children and adults. Well, a few weeks ago, a group in University of Cincinnati Medical School, Bruce Lanfear's group, it's one of the top pediatric toxicology groups in the world, came out with a study. What they did was they investigated the urine concentration of pregnant women, BPA urine concentration in pregnant women, I think it's 16 weeks and 26 weeks. And then they looked at the school behavior of 2-year-old children. And they found that there are definite effects on girls and not so definite effects on boys, but there are certainly definite effects on the behavior of these kids who have been exposed to BPA. So now we have BPA not only as something to worry about for children and adults in the environment, but the fetal environment is now involved with BPA also. What's happened in the past few years is that among pediatric toxicologists, there's a growing awareness that the vulnerability of the fetus is very much different than children and adults, and it hasn't yet penetrated. There's an international group that meets every year or two, and at the end of every meeting, someone steps out. Philippe Grandjean is one of the people who usually does it. He steps out with a statement to the press, a worrisome statement that we're living in a toxic soup and the effects on the fetus are really something to be concerned about, and the media never pays much attention to it. It just goes on and on like that year after year, and I think we're ultimately headed for a tremendous wake-up that's really going to be alarming to people, because we have at the present time, the estimate is about 80,000 synthetic chemicals in our environment, in the air, water, and food. Some of them are relatively indestructible. And we have investigated at this point only a few hundred as far as the toxic effects are concerned. So we're living in a soup that's potentially extremely dangerous, and we're only beginning to understand the ramifications of all of this.
I actually think that, I don't want to be alarmist, but I really feel that this is an issue that has a magnitude equivalent to global warming, and that we're about 20 years behind global warming in terms of our awareness and proof curve. And it may take another 20 years before this becomes a political issue, because there are so many entrenched economic interests.
Yes, that's a very, very big problem. You have the chemical industry involved in this and all kinds of industries, and the attitude is that push problems like this aside and pretend they don't exist.
And wait for definitive proof, by which time, of course, the horse has, as I like to say to my patient, the horse done left the barn. The issues with BPA also affect certain mental illnesses. In page 221 of your book, you quote a research study showing that there is a correlation between bisphenol A and schizophrenia, in terms, I presume, of maternal blood levels as well.
Yes, I'd like to make a point about this business with toxic impacts and mental illness. There's an important thing that has to be considered here that's maybe unique to a developmental situation. My impression, and it's not an impression that's unique to me, is that for a single impact, there are many, many possible outcomes in terms of developmental consequences. And that at the end, if you have a particular developmental consequence, there are many, many different kinds of impacts that might have been the cause of that consequence. We have a multiplicity on two ends, multiplicity of outcomes and multiplicity of impacts, and it makes the etiology extremely complicated. For example, I think it's a real mistake to focus on looking for single genes as the determinant of any particular mental illness. I think that's just a blind alley. I think it's all multi-gene etiology. And at the same time, on the other end, if you have a particular set of symptoms, psychiatric symptoms, which is usually all we have to go on because there's no real etiology for most psychiatric conditions. If you have a particular set of symptoms, one has to assume that there are many different ways, many different kinds of impacts that can produce that set of symptoms. We have a tendency to look for simple answers and quick fixes, and it just doesn't work when it comes to development.
It would seem, when one takes all of the different environmental inputs that you discuss in your book, More Than Genes, that our best solution is to seek to limit our exposures as much as possible on the assumption that there is probably some genetic vulnerability or other present in ourselves, even though that may not be the case. It's why push your luck? What kind of strategies, if any, can you suggest practically?
Okay, we'll talk about practical strategies.
Yeah.
First of all, we can't put pregnant women in a bubble. That's number one. We can't do that. That's out of the question, and nobody's going to tolerate that.
But should we prohibit them from working at certain employments where they're exposed to solvents, for example?
Yes, I was going to mention that. There's good evidence that workplace volatile organic solvents are extremely dangerous. For example, it doesn't even have to be workplace. Acetone is the main solvent in nail polish remover, and acetone is toxic. There's no question about that. The image I have in my mind is a young woman bending over to remove nail polish from her fingernails, and she's breathing in acetone, and if she happens to be pregnant, it's not too good for the fetus. The workplace volatile solvent issue is concrete now because we have good evidence that women who work in occupations where they're chronically exposed to volatile organic solvents have a higher incidence of damaged birth outcomes than women who are not in those occupations. So there's no question about that. Now, the issue is protecting them. And I have no political solutions or economic solutions to that. My concern at the present time is to make people cognizant of the existence of these problems, because from a practical point of view, as a society, we can't begin to solve a problem until the problem is defined. And right now, for me, the important thing to do is define the problem for people so that they understand that there is a relatively serious problem. And then we can sit down after we recognize the existence of a problem and start considering which solutions are practical and which solutions are not practical. I don't think there's too much that can be done by individual pregnant women aside from the ordinary things, although I really would like to see a reduction in the percentage of women who are continuing to drink after they already know they're pregnant. The percentage, I think, in California is as high as 25%. I think that's a disaster. It's an absolute disaster.
Why don't you amplify on that a little bit? You have some very interesting numbers around what it takes to create fetal alcohol syndrome. I'm not sure if the case of the woman who has 6 drinks at a party when she's 3 weeks pregnant is a made-up case or if that's an actual case study. It read like a case study.
Well, you're talking about the anecdote?
Yes.
The anecdote is made up. I made up that anecdote, but there's enough in the literature to support the idea. I mean, I didn't conjure this out of thin air. I mean, there's no question about permeability of cell membranes to alcohol, and there's no question that what we do know about fetal alcohol syndrome is that the earlier the exposure, the more damaging the effect. The idea that women in the conception stage, for some time before they know they're pregnant, that's a physical fact, and if they're continuing to drink the way they were drinking before they ever intended to get pregnant, then there's a danger to the fetus. And the point that I make in the book is that fetal alcohol syndrome and fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, which is the more vague set of symptoms, are already clinical entities. And we haven't even begun to discuss subclinical problems, which are not recognized in the clinic. But we can't arbitrarily establish a cutoff point and say that below this there are no effects at all, and above this you get clinical effects. It doesn't make any sense to do that. So my assumption is, my argument is, that any exposure to alcohol, and we do know that there are good physical reasons and chemical reasons not to expect the threshold, any exposure to alcohol after conception is potentially dangerous for the embryo. And that's the basis for that anecdote that started off the chapter on alcohol.
Well, I was struck with your estimate that, quoted estimate, I'm not sure where this comes from, the incidence of fetal alcohol spectrum disorder in the U.S. is currently 1 in 100 live births, about 1% of the total population, which is more common than both Down syndrome and spina bifida put together.
Yes. Yes, I think it's a critical problem. And, you know, this is a social problem. It's really a social problem. When is the last time you saw a billboard on a highway telling women who are thinking of becoming pregnant or already pregnant not to drink alcohol? You don't see such things. That's a social problem. We don't pay enough attention socially as a society to these problems. It's a disaster for us. It's a disaster for us. I remember on a trip to Denmark in the 1960s, it's a long time ago, I was shocked to see huge billboards with skulls and crossbones telling people not to smoke cigarettes. We never saw anything like that in this country.
Well, we'll see it if we ever get national health. Because then there'll be an economic reason that will overwhelm the current economic bias, which is in favor of freedom of the market.
Well, you know, for me, I'm not political. I don't advocate any political ideology, but it seems to me that if human misery is simply correlative damage in the hunt for profits, there's something wrong with the way we're living our lives. There's something wrong with the society if we have a system where there are people being poisoned or people being damaged or people without adequate health care, and it's all justified with the idea that this is part of the survival of the fittest game, which I think is total nonsense. I don't think that humanity has to live like that. I don't think that humanity has to bend under to the dictates of Darwinian evolution. I don't think it's necessary at all. As a matter of fact, for me, if you walk into any intensive care unit, what you're looking at, as far as I'm concerned, is a defection from Darwinian evolution. I don't think it's necessary. I don't think we have to sacrifice our principles of freedom in order to understand that there are better ways to do certain things.
You spend some time in your book on the, and I found this a fascinating section, talking about gender and gender identity.
Yes,
and the possible ways that the fetal environment may determine gender identity. And two things that I wanted to discuss. One is the birth order and homosexuality in men, and the other is the second to fourth digit ratio and what that might imply. Let's start with the index to ring finger digit ratio.
That's right. It's the second and fourth digit. Exactly. They have found the differences, but I haven't seen an adequate explanation of it.
But the actual difference is that males tend to have a longer fourth digit relative to their index finger.
Yes.
And
yes,
females tend to have a ratio of index to fourth finger greater than one and males less than one.
Yes. The explanation when it finally arrives will probably have something to do with androgen, but I can't say anything about it because I haven't seen a satisfactory explanation for it. But the data is firm. There's no question about that. The data is firm.
So theoretically, if it were androgen exposure in utero, you'd have a very good example of something influencing growth in a seemingly unrelated area.
Yes, of course, it's not the only example. I think there are other examples that are already firm, and we already know that the secretion of the sex hormones by the fetus itself is one of the events that pushes sexuality in one direction or another.
So is there any correlation with, say, homosexual males having a higher 2-to-4 ratio than heterosexual males?
I've seen one or two papers, but I don't know that I trust it. I don't know. I don't want to be firm about this because I don't have...
No, that's fine. That's fine. I don't want to belabor the issue. Let's visit the topic of the birth order in male homosexuality.
Birth order. Well, the only explanation for that I've heard that makes any sense is that it's a question of antibodies that are building up.
Let's define it first before we explain it. So the evidence epidemiologically is, and correct me if I'm wrong, without equivocation that homosexual men have a greater number of older brothers than heterosexual men, the odds ratio of being homosexual increase by 33% with each older brother. Thus, a statistical analysis would be that approximately 1 in 7 homosexual men, there is a relation to fraternal birth order effect, but there's no such effect in females.
Yes.
And there's also a birth weight effect. Homosexual men tend to have a lower birth weight. And that's where maternal immunity theory is coming in as a possible explanation for this, that having had multiple boys, a woman's body actually makes antibodies against some aspect of the male fetus, male-linked antigens.
Yes, you know, the problem is that the science here is only a few years old.
Right, right.
And there's so much going on between conception and the time that the testing and time the sexuality matures and that people wind up with one sexuality or another, that to parcel out influences prenatal and postnatal is extremely difficult. I don't know. I think that at this stage, there's nothing wrong with a position that says that we don't know yet.
Nothing at all. I think that what I derive from looking at these very, very preliminary correlations and findings is not some kind of theory of male homosexuality,
right,
but more an overwhelming sense that, like the finger lengths between males and females and like the differences in IQ that can be attributed to early prenatal exposure to lead, that much of who and what we are is outside of our will and outside of our volition.
I agree totally with you.
And you would not condemn a child who had developmental disability because of lead exposure in utero. Why would you condemn a child who is homosexual as if they had some choice in the matter?
Exactly, exactly, absolutely. As a matter of fact, I personally believe, and this is just a conjecture, I personally believe that sexuality is primarily determined during fetal development. But I can't make a demonstration of that, and I can't argue too long about it because there just isn't enough evidence. There's lots of speculation. There's evidence where the conclusions are arbitrary. So my hunch is that fetal development is the first 9 months during development. It's extremely easy to push the sexuality of the genitals and the sexuality of the brain in different directions.
I want to emphasize that, speaking as I believe we both are, as primarily scientists, we both realize that we're filtering the scientific evidence and these hypotheses that these observations generate through our own moral and cultural preconceptions. And
yes,
that if the history of science teaches us anything, it's that you have to be very careful about projecting interpretation onto observation. And one of the great things in your book that I really enjoyed was the anecdote about pseudoscience involving mother cats the so-called maternal instinct. Can you walk us through that? Because I thought that was a beautiful example of how an observation...
I've been carrying that around with me for 50 years.
I love it, though. I'm sure you've used it in every class, and it's worth using again, so go for it.
The anecdote involves what we call maternal instinct, the idea that behavior can be fractionated into an agglomeration or collection of instincts. Human behavior is a simple idea that appeals to many people, but the fact is that science doesn't support that particular approach. And the example, my favorite example, is the so-called maternal behavior of a cat. When a new litter of kittens is born, the mother cat immediately proceeds to lick away the membranes that are covering the kittens. And if she doesn't do that, the kittens will die very rapidly. And it turns out that the reason that she does that is that these membranes have a high salt concentration, and one of the consequences of the pregnancy of that mother cat is that she has essentially a salt deprivation. So she's licking the membranes because she wants the salt. If you take a tennis ball and you soak it in a salt solution and you toss the tennis ball to the mother, she will start licking the tennis ball and she will let the kittens die. So the anecdote is so much from maternal instinct. It's all physiology and biochemistry. And if we can deconstruct instincts, that's what we find. We find that it's all physiology and biochemistry that's inherited. It's not any particular behavior pattern. It's physiology and biochemistry that result in a particular behavior given contact with the environment. That's the key. That's the key. We don't inherit behaviors. We inherit physiology and biochemistry that results in a particular behavior given contact with a specific environment. Behavior is always environmentally dependent. There's no question about that. The genes, evolution has provided us with genes. The analogy I use is that the evolution of genes has given us a floorboard, the floorboards for an opera. The arias and the drama and the story of the opera, that's all culture and environment, as far as I'm concerned. Evolution has given us the floorboards, and the opera itself is something quite different.
Let me ask you, do you have any things that we haven't discussed that you feel would be important to include in here? We've meandered around most of the topics that are covered in your book, but what, if anything, do you feel is important to emphasize that we may have left out?
Well, I think for me the most important part of the book is the last chapter that discusses the impact of culture and poverty on fetal development. I think that's an area that the toxicologists are not going to deal with because it's out of their experience. It's an area that people in the social sciences, I would hope, would get involved with, because I do think that there are things going on that are of extreme importance. And one of the things I mention in the book is this idea of poverty as a transgenerational disease. I think that's very, very important. And the idea is really not complicated. The idea is that if you have fetal impacts which affect fetal development, particularly neurodevelopment, the consequence is that the offspring, the children, are less capable of dealing with the stresses of society and with finding employment and so on than the children who haven't been so impacted. These children, because of the nature of our society, are in turn subjected to more toxic impacts than other children, than, let's say, middle or upper class children. And they in turn will have children who will be the grandchildren of the mothers that we started out with at the beginning. And this will carry on from generation to generation, with each generation, particularly the females in the generation, being handicapped by fetal impacts. And it's a cycle that's extremely difficult to break out of, because in this society, people who are less capable of coping with the stresses of a free market society usually are not as healthy as other people. Usually their fetuses are subjected to the toxic impacts and to the problems that arise from lack of prenatal care. It's an ongoing problem that I really think hasn't been adequately addressed. I, for example, am very strongly in favor, no matter what the cost, of having completely free and without stigma prenatal care for every woman in the country. If a woman is pregnant, she gets prenatal care, no questions asked. No questions about income or whatever, it's irrelevant. She's pregnant, she gets free prenatal care. I think until we reach the stage where we're willing to do that, we can't call ourselves a mature society.
Do you think that just the provision of prenatal care will have in any way an impact on these complex issues?
No, absolutely not. It's not enough. There's no question about that, but at least we should have that. That's the point. At least we should have that. That's the important thing. I mean, there are countries that do have that. I mean, why do we have to be last on the list? I see no reason for that.
None at all. I agree. I want to raise the stakes on your last comments, though, and talk about just briefly epigenetics. This is a topic that we've spent a great deal of time on in previous programs. And in your previous comments just now, talking about the cycle of poverty and the challenges that it creates for the individual, which reinforce and amplify cycle of poverty, you didn't talk about epigenetics, but we do know that there are changes in the mother's environmental milieu when she is subjected to chronic stress, and very clear evidence that chronic stress levels are higher when you're in a poverty state.
Yes.
So given that, we know that that has an effect that is persistent on the DNA of the offspring, at least out to the second generation, and presumably the third or the fourth, although we have human data on this now, which is...
Yes, there's accumulating data about that. I haven't talked about it during this conversation because we haven't mentioned gene expression
no.
at all. We've stayed away from
it. No, but it's in
trends.
Your book, and fair game.
Yeah, I can point it out publicly as follows. Up until about, I would say, 10 or 15 years ago, maybe even 10 years ago. Up until 10 years ago, the focus of people who were involved in tracing the relationship between genes and what's happening not only during development but in the childhood and adult body, the focus was on genes alone. And what happened was it was discovered first in very primitive biological systems that the developmental process depends very much on interactions with the local environment, that these interactions act as triggers for these cascades that I mentioned. And the term epigenetics came into use, and what it really means is the interaction of the environment with gene regulators. most people are aware that every cell in the human body has the same genome, but what differentiates one type of cell from another type of cell is which genes are turned on and which genes are turned off in that particular type of cell. And that's determined by gene regulators, some of which are in the genome itself and others of which are part of the biochemical environment of the DNA. What happened was that we came to realize that these gene regulators are very heavily influenced by interaction with the local cellular environment. This is essentially what the field of epigenetics is all about. And in the book, I discuss a thing called the Dutch Hunger Winter, which occurred during the Second World War and really did not become well-known any place outside the Netherlands until the 1980s. Holland is a very special place when it comes to epidemiology because very careful birth records are kept of everyone. And what happened during the Second World War is that in retaliation for an attempt by the Dutch resistance to interfere with the movement of troops in Holland, the Nazis put a very large area of Holland under restricted caloric intake. They essentially starved many, many thousands of people to death as a consequence. And there were many women who were pregnant during that time of malnutrition. The malnutrition was severe. People were eating anything they could. But Holland kept very careful records of these women and their caloric intake and their children and so on. And 20 years later, a combined British and Dutch research team did a study of the children of these women, and they discovered that there was a very high incidence of obesity and heart disease among the children of women who were suffering from malnutrition during the so-called Dutch hunger winter. And this started a hypothesis called fetal programming, which was first formulated by the Englishman David Barker. In any case, this idea excited many, many people in the sciences. And the idea essentially is that the conditions that a fetus experiences, the environmental conditions that a fetus experiences, play a role in the development of tissues and organs and the physiology of those tissues and organs. And the entire developmental process is geared to see the fetus through to a birth. It's geared to the survival of the fetus. And so if the fetus is in an environment during development that's essentially below par as far as caloric intake is concerned, this is going to set, it's going to program the development of the cells and tissues and organs of the fetus to be able to exist in such an environment. What happens then is that the fetus develops to term, and we have an infant and a child who is in an environment that's not below par as far as caloric input is concerned, and the consequence is obesity. And related to that is effects on development of the heart and the functioning of the heart. So this is the physical analog to what I talk about in the book. The book is focused primarily on the effects of fetal environment, fetal environmental impacts on behavior and intelligence. But behind it all is very concrete, very solid evidence that the fetal environment can program physiology not only into the next generation, but across several generations. There's very good evidence for the programming of physiology. What I'm focusing on in the book is the programming of behavior, which is a different ballgame altogether.
Or maybe not.
Well, maybe not is right. You're right. Absolutely right.
Dan, you make a really profound call for rethinking our definition of what social justice really means, with respect to providing a level playing ground for people at the, well, at the instant of their fertilization, really, and doing our very best to protect all people during their most vulnerable prenatal experiences. There are a lot of unfinished questions, a lot of unanswered questions about how to do this, obviously. But I want to thank you very much for bringing our attention to what has been largely a black box, the idea that what happens in utero is determined by genetics and really isn't all that influenced except in a few cases of poisoning, to opening up the idea that just about anything can have an effect on someone, and we need to try and identify those effects and study them and influence them. This is a real paradigm shift in the way we think about human rights. So I want to thank you for providing us with a very big thought problem, and definitely something that will require much thought and discussion in future years. Any last words for the audience?
Yes, I want to leave people with a phrase. There is no such thing as an immaculate gestation. It doesn't exist.
No such thing as an immaculate gestation. There you have it. Dan Agin, thank you very much for being on our program. We're most grateful and look forward to talking with you when you have another book.
Okay, thank you very much. It's my pleasure.
Thank you. Here are a few bits of recent news articles that I think you'll find interesting, particularly in reference to our previous conversation. This research was recently presented at the annual meeting of the Radiological Society of North America. It was a study using functional magnetic resonance imagery, or fMRI, to evaluate brain function in adults who had been exposed to lead as children. I want to point out that when the study was actually initiated, there was no such technology. This collaborative Cincinnati lead study, as it's called, followed prenatal and early childhood lead exposure of 376 infants from high-risk areas of Cincinnati, and it ran from 1979 to 1987 to identify those children. Over the course of that project, the children underwent behavioral testing and 23 different blood analyses per child to yield a mean blood lead level. Lead, unfortunately, is one of the banes of modern life. It's a potent poison. It's found in water, soil. It's in lead-based paint. It's in lead pipes in older buildings. And as that paint peels off of the walls and turns into dust, it is absorbed by children, and it is especially toxic to the developing nervous system. Now, most of the research, including what we talked about with Dan Agin, was around the idea of measurable IQ points. This study goes deeper than that and looks at actual brain functioning in adults who were toxically exposed to lead in childhood and how they differ from the standard issue adult brain functioning. The study was performed by Dr. Kim Cecil, a PhD in imaging science at Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center and a professor of radiology, pediatrics, and neuroscience at the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine. Dr. Cecil's study involved 33 adults who had enrolled as infants in the Cincinnati lead study. The mean age of the study participants was 21 years, and mean blood levels had ranged from 5 to 37 micrograms per deciliter, with an average of 14. All of the histories of the participants showed IQ deficiencies, juvenile delinquency, and a number of criminal arrests, all of the things that we have associated in the past with high levels of lead. In this study, each participant underwent functional MRI while performing two different tasks designed to measure brain's executive functioning. Executive functioning is like that secretary who sits in your office and tells you where you need to be, when you need to be there, and why you need to be there in that particular order with this file or that file in your hand so that you can do your job. Executive functioning also governs impulse control. Not now, Mr. Jones. It's time to go to the meeting. Essentially, the task of the executive functioning is inhibition, calming you down, containing your animal impulses, and getting you to focus your attention without distraction on the task at hand. What the imaging tests revealed was that in order to accomplish a task that required inhibition, those who had had increased blood lead levels required activation of additional areas of the frontal and parietal lobes of the brain. The damage to the prefrontal cortex was significant in these individuals, such that other parts of the brain actually had to step in and contribute energy in order that the person could focus. This is in sharp distinction
to individuals who did not have high levels, whose prefrontal cortex was able to provide sufficient inhibition to allow for the performance of these tasks. One of the key findings back in the late 1980s of the Cincinnati-led study was that the correlation between juvenile delinquency and poor behavior was strongest with those with high lead levels and not so highly correlated with poor social environment, which had been the previously attributed cause of juvenile delinquency. Now, looking at these now grown-up children, we see that in fact their brains function differently. Impulse control and focus and attention all actually take more effort from more parts of the brain in individuals who suffered from lead exposure in childhood. It's not just about IQ, is the message here. It's about behavior patterns and also lost potential. Any child who is poisoned in their potential by high levels of lead exposure in childhood represents a social loss. I believe as a society that we should be looking for ways to avoid such losses in the future now that we understand their impact. This is Dr. Dawn for now saying so long and stay healthy.